At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's one of those nasty sayings that makes the rounds occasionally on Wall Street, mostly behind closed doors. Let's put some lipstick on this pig. You know, make an investment look a lot more attractive than it should be. Those aren't the exact words that turned up in the email at Bear Stearns, but federal prosecutors say what they found is a crime. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity, online at us.areva.com. And by Clarks and Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. We're glad to have you with us on this Thursday, the 19th of June. And if you were hoping you'd heard the last of the damage caused by mortgage-backed securities, sorry to say, there's more to come. Citigroup shares crumbled 1% after the bank warned investors to expect more write-downs. And the FBI arrested two former Bear Stearns executives on charges of securities fraud. They're accused of misleading investors about the state of two hedge funds that bought lots of mortgage-backed bonds. The executives may also have lied about the amount of their own money they invested in those funds. This news is casting a long shadow down Wall Street and raising a potentially profit-killing question. How can you trust what any of these financial folks say? Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports.
Hedge fund investors may be wealthier than the rest of us, but U.S. Attorney Ben Campbell says they're entitled to the same protections.
Honesty and integrity are the foundations upon which our financial markets function. Hedge fund investors, like all investors in the securities markets, are entitled to rely on those to whom they entrust their money.
The Bear Stearns executives who manage the hedge funds told investors they were cautiously optimistic about the mortgage market. But then the hedge funds blew up. So after the Enron and WorldCom frauds, the equity analyst lies, and now this. Can we ever trust anything anyone says on Wall Street anymore? Lane Carrick is the chief executive of Sovereign Wealth Management. He says he never takes anything hedge fund managers say at face value.
The term cautiously optimistic would be meaningless to me as an investor.
Carrick says he focuses on numbers more than words.
I guess it would be a little Reagan-esque in that it would be trust but verify.
Sophisticated investors like the people who invest in hedge funds are supposed to know what they're getting into. Ira Press is a securities litigator at Kirby McInerney.
There is a doctrine called truth on the market, which essentially means that a manager is not liable for securities fraud, even if they publicly lie, if in fact the true state of affairs should have been ascertainable to investors through other sources.
Press doesn't think all investment managers are liars. He says fraud occurs in a very tiny percentage of securities transactions. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
More fallout from the mortgage mess today. The FBI revealed a big crackdown on home loan fraud. Roughly 400 real estate industry participants have been indicted since March as part of an investigation dubbed Operation Malicious Mortgage. On Capitol Hill, legislation aimed at helping homeowners avoid foreclosure has hit a couple of snags. First, the White House warned that President Bush will veto the rescue plan as it now stands. and a group of Republicans is trying to block the bill taken up by the Senate today. They argue it's nothing but a bailout for mortgage lenders, one of which is accused of giving two Democratic senators favorable loans. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The mortgage bill expands the Federal Housing Administration's insurance program by $300 billion. That would help struggling first-time borrowers refinance their mortgages. But the White House, supported by Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn, says the plan puts taxpayers at risk.
It's really a question of should the government be subsidizing and incentivizing bad behavior on the part of loan makers?
Coburn has joined a group of Republicans asking that the bill be set aside in the wake of allegations that the sponsor, Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, is one of two senators who received a favorable interest rate from the nation's largest mortgage lender, Countrywide Financial. But with new foreclosures averaging 9,000 a day, many Republicans support the rescue plan, especially those from hard-hit states, like Senator Mel Martinez of Florida.
The fact of the matter is that this is a program geared to help individuals. We shouldn't get distracted with side issues.
The congressional timetable of having a bill on the president's desk by July 4th was thrown in doubt by today's White House veto threat. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Energy speculators could take it on the chin from a couple of major developments in the oil market. China keeps the retail cost of gasoline and diesel artificially low with government subsidies, but today it announced a stunning 18% price increase. Analysts say the move could cause a significant drop in demand from the world's second largest oil user. World oil prices dropped as much as $3 a barrel today. And in Iraq, several Western oil companies are on the verge of returning to work there for the first time in 36 years. Exxon, Shell, Total, and BP are reportedly close to deals with the Iraqi oil ministry. In the short term, the deals would aim to rebuild Iraq's oil industry. But as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, big oil has the long term in mind.
Right now, Iraq produces about 2 million barrels of oil per day out of a global total of more than 80 million barrels. The Iraqi oil ministry thinks Western technology can boost production by 500,000 barrels a day. So the plan is to bring in these oil companies on short-term service contracts. Bob Ebel is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
They'll come in, expand production, and go away. They're going to stick around, though, because they hope, well, what access can we get? Do we have a leg up on the other companies?
A leg up, or this is a foothold for them.
And I'm sure they look at it that way.
That's what worries James Paul, who directs the Global Policy Forum. Iraq has the world's second largest known oil reserves, and he says these contracts will likely lead to lucrative revenue-sharing agreements. Decisions like this, he says, should not be made while the U.S. has so much influence in Baghdad.
We're talking about a sovereign country or a country that wants to, do business on its own. And as long as the United States is occupying that country, it's not a good thing.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice today denied any U.S. government involvement in the contracts and said increased oil production would be a good sign. Bob Ebel says the difference would amount to less than 1% of global output.
It's not a step that's going to cause the oil price to drop dramatically. In fact, it'll probably just keep it where it is.
In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Today's positive oil developments brought some cheer to Wall Street, and we'll have the details when we do the numbers. You've undoubtedly heard the old saying, you have to spend money to make money. For most entrepreneurs, though, it's more like you have to borrow money to make money. But just try getting yourself approved for a loan these days. A recent survey from the National Small Business Association found that more than half of small business owners are having trouble borrowing money. And as Stacey Vanek-Smith reports from the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, that's creating a business opportunity of a different kind.
Entrepreneurs may not be able to get credit these days, but they can get credit cards. The Discover Business Card, the MasterCard Business Card, the American Express Plum Card. Business credit cards are growing 27% a year, one of the few bright spots in an industry that's been slammed by growing default rates and thrifty consumers. Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation.
Small business loans now are becoming a new jewel in the credit card industry. Loans that banks don't want to offer at single-digit interest rates. They now are offering it through business cards at double-digit interest rates.
But many entrepreneurs are so desperate for money, they're willing to pay the price.
The interest rate is not as significant as really getting the capital.
Small business owner Zev Feig runs high-end sportswear company Zensa. He says even though he has excellent credit and his company's profits are growing, banks won't lend him money. His capital comes from a stack of plastic.
Building the internet site, marketing, paying for trips, all of that came from really the credit cards.
To compete for customers like Feig, credit card companies are offering more options and perks.
Small business savings on car rental, automatic.
5% cash back bonus on office supplies.
Having the option to defer payment for up to 2 months interest-free could really help with cash flow when you build new stores.
The Visas and Capital Ones of the world are offering new services, too, like free consulting and online social networking communities. Discover Small Business Watch's Sastry Rachakonda says ease and lack of scrutiny are also part of the appeal.
Typically, if you need money from a bank, there is an immense amount of documentation that you need. And on an ongoing basis, if you need $8,000 here or $5,000 there, it's just easy to take it on your business credit card.
But credit card companies could end up taking it on the chin if the declining economy takes a lot of small businesses with it, says industry expert Robert Manning.
Right now, the credit card industry sees this as a great opportunity to augment their losses. But if the economy continues to recede, and if small businesses do take the brunt of it in the short term, the banks will be losing money on the personal credit card side as well as the business side.
It's not a perfect union for small business owners either. Manning says a lot of business credit cards are not subject to interest rate caps. So if a company hits the skids, entrepreneurs could end up paying rates that top 25%. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Picture thousands jumping up and down in Boston today, cheering on the Celtics. The green team paraded through the city's streets to celebrate their first NBA Finals victory in 22 years. In Game 6 of the Finals on Tuesday, they delivered a serious beating to the Los Angeles Lakers, 131-92. But despite that lopsided win, it was a tough fight. But was it the perfect kind of playoff that the National Basketball Association had been looking for? To answer that question, we turn to basketball aficionado and sports writer Henry Abbott. He writes the True Hoop blog for ESPN.com. Hi, Henry.
Hi, how are you, Bob?
Good, thanks. It's a revelation that we broadcast types aren't the only ones to keep an eye on the ratings. So did the playoffs deliver the ratings and thus the revenue that the NBA was hoping for?
Well, I think there was the expectation this could be one of the best years ever with the Lakers and the Celtics in the finals. It was kind of a dream matchup for the NBA, and the results were very good. I don't know if it was quite the shocking results the NBA thought we might get, but the NBA is very pleased to say that the six finals games were the six most watched TV programs in June. The ratings were up 50% in ratings and 61% in viewership compared to last year. Game 6 was the most watched program on TV since the season finale of American Idol, which was in late May. So, you know, very good results for the NBA.
Let's look at the Celtics. Clearly they had some great players here, but I wonder, does the strength lie deeper in say, the managers and the owners, a pretty smart bunch of guys there?
Yeah, there's a very interesting setup in Boston. Wick Grausbeck, who's the chairman, is a really sharp young owner, and their front office is by far the smallest in the league, the people who make the basketball decisions. It's essentially Danny Ainge, this guy Mike Zarin, and three scouts who aren't in the office. And I know Zarin. I'm very impressed by him, and he's one of the heaviest users of a video scouting service called Synergy. He watches all kinds of players, comes up with all kinds of assessments that a lot of teams don't have. I think by being smarter, even with a small front office, they've been able to make some better decisions than other teams.
So does this translate into more sponsorship dollars and jerseys? Sales for the Celtics?
Sure. I mean, the way this makes money for people is very long-term for the most part. I mean, most of the revenue comes from the broadcast deals, which are already in place. You know, they have a little bit better data to show next time the broadcast deals are up. But like you said, selling jerseys, selling tickets for next season, these are all things. And selling all the slew of NBA-themed marketed products, you know, from video games to jerseys, sweaters, headbands, And speaking of team revenue, the Celtics are one of the savviest out there at making money from sponsors. They have little sponsorship logos on almost everything. Even the nameplates in the players' lockers are sponsored by somebody. Downtown Boston is still covered in these big banners promoting the Celtics, and each one of them has the logo of a different corporate sponsor there. So I think if any team out there is prepared to make some money off some publicity, I think they're in the running for the best in the league.
It's not all good news for the NBA, though. You've got one of the best regular seasons in recent history and a dream playoff. And then it's all tainted by the return of the referee scandal. Is this going to be a lingering thing? How long is it going to go on?
I think it's going to go on for a long time. I'm not convinced the NBA has done a good job of refuting the allegations of disgraced former referee Tim Donaghy, who says that essentially the NBA has inspired referees to call games certain ways that would make the league more money. You know, the NBA says, of course, it's a bunch of nonsense and he's not a credible source, et cetera, et cetera. May all be true, but the NBA has very good information, including video and their own internal rating systems, which could refute such claims, and they've kept their cards very close to their chest there. They haven't trusted the public with any additional information other than blanket denials. And I don't think people find it convincing. Various web polls have found between 70 and 90% of people think that Donaghy was telling the truth about a particular series in 2002 where the Kings may have gotten some bad calls against the Lakers.
Something tells me we're going to be debating this for a long time to come. Henry Abbott writes the True Hoop blog for ESPN.com. Thanks for your insights.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Coming up, the art of making a good cup of coffee.
It's a combination of beautiful espresso, beautiful microfoam steamed milk, and then just a lot of real fine muscle movement.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors in tech and travel stocks got a bit giddy after oil prices tumbled today, though the broader market was more restrained. The Dow ended up 34 points, or a quarter of a percent higher, to 12,063. The Nasdaq popped up 32 points, or 1.3%, to 2,462. The S&P 500 edged up 5 points, or nearly 0.4 of a percent, to 1,342. The oil news set champagne corks a-poppin'. In the airline sector, United Airlines stocks rocketed 24%. Delta got a 17% lift. JetBlue also caught some air, climbing nearly 9%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.2%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by BrandWeek, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives with real-time coverage. Now searchable at brandweek.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The annual U.S. Conference of Mayors begins in Miami. Senator Barack Obama and former President Bill Clinton are scheduled to speak over the weekend. It's World Refugee Day. About 40 million people have been uprooted by violence and persecution, according to the United Nations. And summer begins tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdahl. When anybody turns down $80 million, it's going to be news, but especially when it's a candidate for the highest office in the land. Barack Obama announced today he won't accept any federal money for this year's presidential election. There's a strategy at play here. The move frees the Obama campaign to spend as much money as he can raise. But as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, the decision is drawing some fire.
Barack Obama's the first presidential candidate since Watergate to turn down public money for a general election. Activist David R. Cush at Public Citizen feels betrayed.
It's not altogether surprising when someone's raising as much money as he is and breaking fundraising records that he would opt out of the public funding system. But it is very disappointing.
The McCain campaign accused Obama of breaking his word. But Obama said the public financing system is broken. He wants to be armed with enough money to fight what outside groups throw at him. His army of small donors have given him that ammunition.
We've built a grassroots movement of over 1.5 million Americans. We've won the Democratic nomination by relying on ordinary people.
If Obama accepted federal funds, he'd have to limit his spending to just over $84 million this fall and stop collecting private contributions. But Obama's already raised more than three times that amount. And David R. Kush says lots of that money has come from wealthy insiders.
He's raised over $90 million from people who gave $1,000 or more.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, 55% of Obama's cash comes from so-called big donors, folks who have given at least $200. Julie Presley is one of them.
No, I don't feel like a big donor. If you knew what my salary was, you would. I don't make a lot of money.
Presley, a social worker, has never given more than $25 at a time, but she's given again and again. And somehow, she doubts if elected, Obama will be offering her any special favors. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Congressional and White House negotiators have agreed on what's being described as the most sweeping rewrite of spy powers in three decades. The measure pending in the House would expand the government's powers to spy on communications between the U.S. and overseas. It would also allow the collection of intelligence on matters besides terrorism. Reporter Eric Lischblau writes for the New York Times and is on the line with more on this. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So they've reached an agreement to rewrite the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. What does that mean?
Well, a couple of things. The biggest sticking point had been the question of whether to give immunity to the telephone companies that had participated in the warrantless wiretapping program that President Bush approved after 9/11. There are some 40 lawsuits now pending. They're all consolidated in California. And this agreement essentially does give immunity to the telephone companies. There are some caveats. The government would basically have to certify that it had given proper written requests to the telephone companies. But once that is done, then the language of the bill says that those suits shall be promptly dismissed. So it is, in effect, immunity.
So that apparently gives them at least a court review of sorts.
It's a bit of a court review, but it does not really allow the court to really dig into the issue itself of the warrantless wiretapping program. There's no mechanism for a court to say, what was this program about? Was this program legal? Should the telephone companies have been playing the role that they did? It does not get into issues like that, which folks in the Civil Liberties Committee had wanted the court to be able to explore. And in fact, there are several lawsuits now pending in which the courts had begun to explore those deep issues about the program itself. This bill basically cuts off that sort of avenue and says, if there was written certification to the companies, that's enough.
I've seen this described as a compromise. What's the compromise?
Well, there are a couple of different issues. There are some additional safeguards that the Democrats had sought in terms of congressional review, in terms of an investigation by Congress into the president's NSA wiretapping program. Also, it gives the court, the so-called FISA court, which is the Secret Intelligence Court, more of a role at the beginning of the process in looking at what the NSA is doing and the guidelines it's using in targeting people for surveillance. So there are some additional safeguards that are built into that process.
Is this a done deal? Is this going to be approved this way?
I wouldn't call it a done deal. No, there are certainly folks on both sides of the issue, liberals in the House particularly, who think that this is essentially caving into the White House, and conservatives on the other side who think that it puts in too many restrictions and limits the ability of the NSA to get the intelligence it needs. So, you know, we've been down this road three or four times in the last year and a half, and every time someone thinks there's a deal, it comes unraveled.
Eric Lischblau is a writer for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's pause now for a coffee break. Some of the world's top baristas will gather tomorrow in the Danish capital of Copenhagen for the World Latte Art Championship. Now, if you're envisioning some type of painting or sculpture best enjoyed while sipping your favorite morning brew, that's not it. To borrow an image conjured up by Carly Simon, we're talking clouds in your coffee. Stuart Cohen spent some time at America's Only Latte art competition to find out more about this very elaborate and ephemeral art form.
By now, pretty much everyone knows what a latte is. But what exactly is latte art? Chris Ganger from the Ithaca Coffee Company in Ithaca, New York, explains.
It's a combination of beautiful espresso, beautiful microfoam steamed milk, and then just a lot of real fine muscle movement, coordinated control when you're pouring the drink to make a beautiful pattern on top.
Those patterns in brown and white foam can look like hearts, leaves, ferns, tulips, or combinations of any of those. Ganger says to get good latte art, practice makes perfect.
It's a matter of repeating it 200 drinks a day until it's just muscle memory sort of thing, and you can almost do it blindfolded. If you see it, it's like a visual cue that the drink is going to taste good. You eat first with your eyes, then your taste buds. That's why we do latte art.
Latte art is a growing subculture in the $12 billion a year specialty coffee industry, part of what self-proclaimed coffee geeks call the third wave of espresso.
I would say that even 5 years ago, there were maybe 20 shops in the country that were really pouring good latte art regularly. Now it's got to be over 100.
That's Nick Cho. He owns Murky Coffee in Washington, D.C., and sits on the board of the Specialty Coffee Association of America. He says latte art has also caught on big in Europe and Asia.
And then that's just what we call free pour latte art. Then there's etching, which is a lot like cake decoration. And then when you do that and you apply a stick and kind of manipulate the crema, the brown parts and the white parts at the top of the cappuccino or latte, then, you know, there's millions of different possibilities.
Independent coffee shop owners like Cho see it as a way to differentiate themselves from the big chains and give customers a little something extra. But latte art as a competitive sport? Well, for those involved, it's no joke. There are four regional competitions in the U.S. every year, including here in Washington.
Katie's got two pours out and is working on her third.
Shop owners say it keeps their staff excited about the daily grind of pouring all those cappuccinos and lattes. And now there's big money involved. David Heilbrunn organized the first and only latte art competition in the U.S. 6 years ago. He now has a major sponsor and a $5,000 first prize.
In the early days, we couldn't get 20 competitors to compete, and now we run 40 at each show, and we turn away 20.
And the baristas pouring those little works of art don't seem to mind that it all disappears in just a matter of minutes. In Washington, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
By the way, we have photos and videos of some impressive latte art swirling around on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if your name is John Smith, it'll probably come as no surprise that you shouldn't count on getting a free email account in your name at yahoo.com. Trouble is, with 260 million email addresses already registered on the Yahoo domain, you'll probably find every variation of just about any other name taken as well. So Yahoo is expanding its free email offerings to include two new domains, ymail.com and rocketmail.com. By the way, a recent survey puts Yahoo ahead in registered email users. Microsoft is second with its Hotmail and MSN domains. Google's Gmail ranks third. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 34 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq bumped up 32 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 added 5 points, 0.4%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, John Haas, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, cities jump on the private investment train.
And that will allow us to do thousands of bridge repairs and hundreds of miles of road construction and billions of dollars into public transit over a very long period.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.